From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. College athletes spend a lot of time practicing and playing games. The head of a North Carolina-based higher education watchdog also worries about the amount of travel time linked to college sports. You'll learn why. The head of the University of North Carolina system spends much of her time thinking about economic mobility. She explains the UNC system's role in addressing that issue. North Carolina lawmakers are considering major changes in the way the state selects judges. One expert explains why he believes this state already uses the best possible system. And a North Carolina regulatory expert examines a new national media report. It touted the benefits of reforming state occupational licensing restrictions. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Mental health experts are calling for more nurses and more psychologists in North Carolina public schools. The recommendation is just one facet being discussed by lawmakers who are now looking at how North Carolina might respond to the recent school shooting in Florida and the issues of mental health and facility safety that have arisen. Lindsay Marcello is associate editor of Carolina Journal. She's been reporting on the meetings. Lindsay, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's talk first about mental health. There was a committee meeting. I know that you have been reporting on that. What did we learn from those comments?
Well, from that committee, which was born from the House Select Committee on School Safety, this is one of the working groups, Student Health, Mental Health, we learned that there's a shortage of school psychologists and school nurses in schools across North Carolina. We have a ratio for school psychologists of one to every 2,100 students, and the recommended one is one to 500, 700. And then with school nurses, we have 1 to 1,000 school nurses. And the recommended one from the State Board of Education is 1 to 500 as well.
I think it came out in some of the testimony in your reporting that because of that, there are medical professionals who are serving multiple schools. So what do? Just drive around to different locations?
Yeah, I think they just split up their time between schools. We have, 12 school districts that don't have a single school psychologist. So I'm not sure what they're doing without that person there. They might be pushing off responsibilities to someone who's a little less trained for that sort of position. I know with like school nurses, they're pushing some of the duties onto school administrators, just teaching them basic first aid sort of things. But that's not going to cut it for students with more complex disorders or diseases.
How were lawmakers responding to this as they were hearing these statistics?
They were very troubled by them. They're looking to whether it would be more economically sound to appropriate more funds to hire more school psychologists, or whether it would be better to raise the wages for school psychologists. Because right now in North Carolina, your starting salary is $43,000, and it goes upwards to $61,000. But the national average is $63,000. So we're not very competitive with other states. So we may be losing students who have trained to be school psychologists. We may be losing them to other states. So the lawmakers discussed the idea of maybe raising that competitive wage or doing some more targeted recruitment for students to go through school programs for school psychologists.
Either way, it sounds costly.
It's probably going to be costly, yes. But lawmakers have had the idea in their head for this particular issue that there's no shortage of money for protecting our students. It seems like they're willing to spend as much as possible to protect students. So,
Lindsay, there were also some discussions. There were discussions and comments about other ideas. Something called a peer-to-peer program apparently has been experimented with in other areas. What is that?
So, excuse me. So Representative Torbett was very interested in this idea. He really wanted to talk more about it. But the idea is that students are more likely to talk to each other than they are to talk to an adult if there's something going on with their lives or if they see something. They don't want to be the snitch, so they'd rather tell their friends about it. So the idea is to set up a program where kids can like help each other and talk to each other through mental health issues, teach them about being responsible adults, being civil with one another. One of the programs that's already in effect is called STAMP, and the idea there is that you would have a mentor for each student that needs one, that needs somebody to talk to. So the idea is maybe expanding that program to more schools instead of just the one.
In addition to these issues of mental health, at some point they're going to be talking about the physical safety of the actual school campuses. Have they gotten into any of that yet?
They will in the next working group. They'll talk more about hiring more school resource officers or what kind of things we could do to the buildings themselves to make them safer. Maybe bulletproof windows or doors that are stronger that can be barred against intruders. So those sort of things will be taken up in the next committee meeting.
Lindsay, separate from the issue of responding in some way to the tragedy in Florida, we've also got lawmakers very concerned about low-performing schools. And since you are on the education beat for Carolina Journal, I wanted to talk with you about this. There's something very new and different that is going on that the state is trying, and a Robeson County school is going to be the first school who is put into a different governing category. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so the idea, it was born from a 2016 law originally called the Achievement School District, but it was changed to the Innovative School District. The idea is to take five low-performing schools and to give them, partnering them up with a outside entity like a charter school management company or an education management organization, and to try and help them improve their scores through greater flexibility, a different curriculum, and different hiring practices for teachers. So the first school that was chosen was Southside Ashpool in Robeson County. They have the lowest scores in the state. They haven't met growth in, I think, over 3 years. And so they are really in trouble. And so the idea is they're going to be paired up with Achievement for All Children to try and see if they can improve the scores.
And that is a private firm, right?
That is a private firm, yes.
And they have experience in taking over schools, essentially, and trying to put them on a right track, a turnaround operation?
Achievement for All Children is relatively new. I think they've only been around for like 1 year, so their track record is a little mixed.
Ah, interesting.
But they're partnering up with Team CFA, which has operated several charter schools across the country, but particularly 13 in North Carolina. So that relationship kind of helps them get that credibility to run Southside Ashpool.
This whole idea of taking these low-performing schools and trying to do something, since clearly the status quo is not working, it has not been without controversy. There are some folks who don't like this idea at all. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so when Southside Ashpool was first chosen, there was a lot of pushback from the local community in Robeson County. There was talks of maybe closing the school because that was the only option they would have aside from accepting the recommendation. They'd either, you know, partner up with this outside entity or they would close down entirely. So there was talk to do that, but Dr. Eric Hall, he's the ISD superintendent. He went down to Robeson County. He talked to the local community there. He talked to the school administrators and to the teachers. And I think he really turned their opinions around about this idea. And so they ended up, the school board down there ended up approving the recommendation. So that pushback is not as prevalent anymore. But there's still some concerns that since this is a relatively new thing, that you know, some people are afraid of what this could mean, whether or not it'll make a difference.
Now, you mentioned that five schools essentially were put in the hopper for being a part of this, and we know that this particular school, Ashpool, is the first one that's going to get going. How prevalent are low-performing schools in North Carolina? I mean, did they have, sadly, a lot of schools to choose from to put on this list of five?
I believe so, yes. It's not good. But the original list started out with 48 schools, and Dr. Eric Hall, he looked at their test performances, their growth, and a lot of other data factors, and started shrinking that list down. He went from 48, he went to 6, then to 4, and then finally to Southside Ashpool. Originally, they were going to choose two schools to start out, but because this is a new thing, Hall was more comfortable just recommending one school for the start.
And hopefully this is going to bring hope to the parents of those kids who are in this low-performing school. But as always, only time will tell as to how effective this is. I take it you're probably going to be following this story as well.
Oh, certainly, yes. I believe starting in August is when Achievement for All Children will open the school up again, and then we'll see what happens after that. But, yeah.
We'll have you back to talk about that. And also, as we continue into this process of looking at how the state of North Carolina may respond in terms of mental health issues and physical campus issues, now that we look like we're reacting to what occurred in Florida. Lindsay Marcello is Associate Editor of Carolina Journal. You can read all of her work on these consequential issues at carolinajournal.com. Lindsay, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at carolinajournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. College athletes spend a lot of time both practicing for their sports and playing the games themselves, but they also spend a lot of time traveling for competition. And athlete travel recently generated a lengthy story in one of North Carolina's largest newspapers. But our next guest highlighted the same issue weeks earlier. Jenna Robinson is president of the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. Welcome back, Jenna.
Hey, Mitch.
Why was athlete travel something that the Martin Center decided was something that should be highlighted?
Well, I started thinking about it because over the Thanksgiving break, I was watching the tournament in the Bahamas where NC State went to compete and just really had a terrible time of it. They won one game and then lost the other two. And so they, you know, they went all this way at great expense. The players didn't get to go home for Thanksgiving break. And they didn't really seem any further along in the goals for the team. And so I started to think about all of these. It seems like a proliferation of preseason tournaments, big travel tournaments that are, you know, it's not their conference tournament. It's not the NCAA tournament. It's just kind of like extra preliminaries. And so I started to think about, well, what is this really doing to the team? What are the demands of this on athletes? And we already know that the demands on athletes are far more than a typical student. And so I started to look into it, and, you know, my instincts were right. This travel is a problem.
And I suspect that from your vantage point at the Martin Center, you'd still have this concern, even if NC State had gone and done really well in this tournament. I mean, they're still traveling to the Bahamas, taking
right.
time off from school to do all this.
Right. Absolutely. I still would have had the same concern, but I think it, you know, it just made it so very clear that, you know, they went all this way and got really nothing out of it.
From your vantage point as the head of a leading higher education watchdog group here, why is this something that you should be looking at and that universities should be looking at?
I think the biggest reason is that academics should come first. Even the NCAA admits that most of their students go pro in something else. They don't go pro in their sport. And so student athletes, all students need to leave school with, you know, skills and talent for the future other than athletic talent. And that travel time is really eating into the time that athletes have for their classes. And a lot of it, as I said, is in fact kind of preseason and non-conference travel. And so it is that the seasons have been growing longer. And of course, the conferences have been growing bigger, which means that travel time has been increasing. And students generally miss you know, one or two classes a week during the season and even during the preseason in order to do all of this travel.
When these student athletes are not able to attend the classes, when they're out of – even out of the state or out of the country in the case of the tournament that you're talking about for a week or so at a time, does this really stop them from having the same type of college experience that a quote-unquote normal student would have?
You know, I think it does, because the athletes themselves have said they want more time to relax by themselves. They want more time to see their families. Some of them in Divisions 2 and 3 want more time to work jobs. And, you know, very few of them say they want more time for academics, because they say they're already putting in a lot of time for academics, because, of course, they're pushed to do that to stay eligible. But they do want more time for all of the other things that make college an experience rather than just a degree.
We are speaking with Jenna Robinson, who is the president of the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. I mentioned at the top of this interview that a little bit after the Martin Center set the stage for this, one of the state's largest newspapers did a major report on this same issue, mm-hmm. athlete travel. And another thing they brought up in this report was the notion that it's not just these tournaments, but also expanding conferences means right. that there's a lot more long-distance travel, not only in the Atlantic Coast Conference that mm-hmm. we know about, but all of these other major conferences right. that have expanded. The other teams are further away, mm-hmm. so even going to a conference game takes longer. You might miss more classes that way.
Right, absolutely. And we, in looking at, I used Duke as an example, and a lot of their play, even in conference, was far away, was out of state. They had, I think, three conference games in state. The rest of them were out of state games, and I think most of them would, in fact, require an airplane trip, not just, you know, driving to a nearby state.
In looking at this change, a lot of it just seems to be tied into this whole notion of the tail wagging the dog, so to speak,
right.
that the athletics is really driving this process mm-hmm. more than this notion of, we have students, let's give them this athletic opportunity. It's mm-hmm. more, we've mm-hmm. got this athletic program, and let's kind of act as if these people are also students.
Right. Absolutely. I think that becomes more and more true. There are a lot of Division I athletes, especially in basketball and football, who are putting in enough time for their athletics only to be a full-time job. And so they really are students second. And that's not the way it's supposed to be. It is absolutely detrimental to their future. You know, very few of them make it to the NFL or the NBA. And for all of those who don't, you know, the graduation rates are lower, the dropout rates are higher, the academic performance suffers. And obviously they're not getting all of the other things that students are able to do on campus. They're not doing the networking. They're not getting to career services. They're not doing all of those things that can prepare them for a future outside of athletics.
Okay, so we see that there's a problem. It's been getting worse. Are there some things that you've identified that universities ought to do to help address this?
Right. Well, the first thing is that the Knight Commission has been saying this for a long time. You know, travel time needs to be decreased. And one thing that the NCAA did recently was to actually freeze the number of tournaments and the number of competitions. And that was a few years ago. And I think that a freeze is a good start. But I do think we need to pull back. A freeze isn't enough. I'm glad it's frozen right now, and I think it's a good time to talk about, well, what is the right amount? And I think that really we need to go back to what we think of as the traditional sports seasons. They shouldn't be lingering either, you know, beginning earlier or kind of lingering longer into the next semester, because students really do need to have some time to dedicate just to academics. And I think on the colleges and universities side, they need to allow students off time when they're not in season. And they need to allow students to be able to count some of the athletic activities that they're doing towards their maximum hours for the NCAA. Because, of course, you know, NCAA says you can only spend 20 hours a week on athletic-related activities. But, you know, universities game it, teams game it, and so they're really spending a lot more time than that.
We have a brief amount of time remaining, but do you sense that there is any appetite among university leaders to do anything about this?
You know, I don't think that there is. It's pretty disappointing. Every once in a while, we'll see a bright spot where a university will pull back. And of course, there's still the Ivy League that I admire for being less in the thrall of athletics than other conferences. But not every conference is the Ivy League. And so I think that this is a problem that we need to keep chipping away at.
And one group that will continue chipping away at that problem is the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. Its president is Jenna Robinson. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mitch.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. UNC System President Margaret Spellings says issues surrounding economic mobility help keep her up at night. She explained during a recent speech in Charlotte.
The American dream holds that talent and hard work lead to a better life, that those willing to put in the effort can prosper. When that belief begins to fray, we all suffer. Our politics become more troubled, our common future more clouded. Without confidence in the American dream, we will fail to tap the talent we must have to thrive. Economic mobility is the defining issue of our time. If you look at a map of economic mobility across the country, our region, from Southern Virginia through Mississippi, is an unhappy outlier. Children born into poverty in the South have strikingly low odds of bettering their lives. In North Carolina, our metro areas rank among the worst in the nation for upward mobility, and right now, Charlotte is at the bottom of that list.
Does this mean sending more kids to college?
I'm not a believer in college for all, and I don't know any university president who is. But I am a believer in education and training beyond high school for nearly everyone, whether that's in school, on the job, or through military service. We are steadily losing jobs for high school graduates and gaining work that requires more education. Our universities must support apprenticeship programs, grant credit for military service, and partner with employers to offer on-the-job training that counts towards a degree or credential. We must broaden options because the students we serve today are more diverse than ever. Any vision that's overly focused on providing four-year degrees to 18-year-olds fresh out of high school won't cut it today. 40% of North Carolina's college students are 22 years of age or older. Many are already working, many have kids, and are looking to us to help them get better-paying jobs to support their families. 36% of North Carolina's college students are enrolled online or in a blend of in-person and online classes. A little over half are in four-year colleges, but 46% are enrolled in two-year programs.
UNC President Margaret Spellings touts a new group, the My Future NC Commission. It will help address her concerns about economic mobility. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina is considering major changes to its system of selecting judges, but at least one national expert likes the system the state uses now, elections with party labels. Chris Bono is professor of political science at the University of Pittsburgh.
There's no perfect way of selecting judges. Each method of judicial selection has its pros and its cons, and it all depends upon what you and the people of North Carolina want in their courts and what they want their judges to do and how they want their judges to be. And so nothing I or anyone else is going to say today is going to be a perfect system. There are always drawbacks. And so what I want to talk a little bit about, though, is judicial elections and partisan elections and how they're not as bad as people say. Now, that you may think is faint praise, but actually it's not, in the sense that there are a lot of virtues to having judicial elections. And there are three primary virtues that I want to touch on here to begin with. The first is information. We know that judges, particularly appellate court judges, policy-making judges, deal with very difficult cases. They deal with difficult cases where the law is not clear, where the facts are not clear. That's why we have judges to interpret them. And we know that liberal judges and conservative judges view the law differently. And that's also okay. And not only is it okay that we all know this, the public knows this as well. And that doesn't erode the legitimacy of the courts. What ends up happening, though, is we tend to pretend like judges are robots, that they go in and they say, oh, here's the law, here's the facts, here's the outcome, and ideology and policy preferences don't play a role. They do play a role. All of you who are lawyers know when you go into a trial and you look up and you see who the judge is, you're going to be kind of happy, or kind of, it's not going to be a good day. And that's okay. It doesn't mean these judges are biased or they're bad people. It just means they view the law differently. They view their role differently. Why not provide that information to the voters? The simplest way to provide that information to the voters is by the party ID of the candidates. This is true at all levels of the judiciary. You can design a system to have maximum judicial independence, like the federal system. It still plays a role. Merrick Garland couldn't even get a vote. Not because he wasn't qualified. Not because people thought he was a bad judge. But because he viewed the law differently than the majority of the Senate wanted him to. Neil Gorsuch had 40 votes against him. Not because he's a bad judge. Jury's still out. Not because but because of how he views the law. These people, good, honest, fair-minded people, view the law differently. Given that politics is involved in judging and politics is involved in judicial selection, with partisan elections, we put that out front for the voters. We provide voters with information. Nonpartisan elections have voters trying to make a choice without a vitally important piece of information for them. That's not helpful.
That's Chris Bono, professor of political science at the University of Pittsburgh. He says there's another advantage linked to partisan elections. They offer voters a choice.
It provides the voters with meaningful choice in a way that retention elections do not. In retention elections, you only get to decide whether or not the current judge should keep his or her job. But you don't know who the replacement's going to be. The replacement could be worse, far worse. I can remember I was giving these talks in Nevada in 2010 when Harry Reid was running for re-election. Harry Reid's approval ratings back then were like in the 30s. People did not like Harry Reid. But he was running against this crazy person named Sharon Angle, who like believed in UFOs and aliens and stuff. And so had Harry Reid been subject to retention, he would have lost. But he was running against Sharon Angle. Like, you know, we don't like Harry Reid, but she's nuts. Right? Nuts. Meaningful choice allows voters to decide who should be on the bench, not just some mythic other person. And it's also unfair to judges to run in retention elections. Because how do you campaign against nobody? How do you campaign against some ideal judge or some unknown quantity? It makes it very hard. It's also unfair because with partisan elections, you have filing deadlines. So if you're running for judge, you know by a certain date if you're going to have an opponent or not. So then you can decide to campaign, to ramp up your campaign, to raise money. Not so with retention elections. There's no opponent. So you can think you're sailing through to retention. No problem. No one's going to oppose you. Then 2 weeks before, some group drops in, you know, a $2 million ad buy against you. And now you're flat-footed. Not only are you running against nobody, but you haven't done the preparation to run an effective campaign to defend yourself because you didn't think you had to. So retention elections are bad on a number of levels.
Bono says partisan judicial elections also boost transparency.
It puts the politics out in front. We know politics is involved. And so we could have a commission system where we have, it's tough sell in this room, right? Where we have a bunch of legal elites, right, go into a room, right, and legal elites know more than everyone else, and then poof, a list of judges comes out, right? Like voting for Pope, right? Not very transparent. Now you can make that system more or less transparent, but it's not very transparent, right? It's very skewed in one direction. Or we can have the politics up front and let voters decide for themselves. And one of the things political scientists have found is that judicial elections actually don't decrease legitimacy of the courts, particularly in states, right, that have had them for a long time, because the voters know this is how judges are selected. This is just the cost of doing business. And yes, it's messy, and yes, sometimes good judges lose. That's true for any office. That's true for state legislature. That's true for judges. That's true for governor. But of the options, of the alternatives, it's the alternative that maximizes the amount of information, promotes the maximum amount of transparency, and gives the voters the highest stake in who sits on the bench.
Bono says removing party labels from judicial selection doesn't remove partisanship.
It's important to remember that if we remove partisan identification from the ballot, it does not remove partisan decision-making. It just simply obscures it from the voters. That is, if a judge is inclined to make decisions based on what his policy preferences are or her policy preferences are or according to their political party affiliation, whatever else, they're still going to do that regardless of whether we provide that information to the voters. So the question is, do we want to provide voters with information or not?
Bono also tackled some myths about judicial appointments. He says most states allow appointed judges to be reappointed. What's the result?
What we found in those states is those judges are less likely to engage in judicial review and strike down laws of the legislature and actions of the governor. Why? Because they want to be reappointed. So there's accountability even in appointed systems. It's not by the voters, but it's by the other political elites who the judges depend upon for their reappointment. So we don't get to some kind of magical independence, perfect system simply by eliminating elections.
There might be one more reason for lawmakers to consider maintaining the status quo.
Every year in states across the country, bills are introduced to change how judges are selected. North Carolina is unique in that you guys actually pass them. And you pass them all the time. Right. And so one of the things I would suggest, I already said I'm not going to tell you what to do, but here's what I'll say. If you're concerned about the legitimacy of the courts, pick something and stick to it for a while, right? And don't keep changing it every time there's a new political party in power, right? Because that will do more to erode the legitimacy of the courts than anything else you do.
That's Chris Bono, University of Pittsburgh political scientist and national expert on judicial selection. He offered these comments during a recent Federalist Society panel discussion in Raleigh. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. A Wall Street Journal editorial is echoing John Locke Foundation recommendations for making it easier to earn a living. The journal's editorial caught the eye of our next guest, John Sanders, who writes that if we really want to lift up North Carolinians, we should reform our state's occupational licensing laws, the subject on which the Wall Street Journal agrees. John, of course, is the director of regulatory studies for the Locke Foundation. He joins us now. John, welcome back.
Thanks, Donna.
When we say occupational licensing, help those of us who are not analysts like you understand what that really is.
Occupational license is generally is basically it's an entry regulation. If you want to get into a particular field, if the state has decided that you need a license for it, then you cannot legally do work in that field without receiving that license. And in order to get the license, you have to attend a set amount of classes, fulfill academic credits, most cases. Sometimes you have to also take several entrance exams. It could be one, it could be 3 to 8, depending. And those, of course, require a lot of time spent studying and money, sitting fees, and you have to drive to where those tests are going to be held. Sometimes you will have to fulfill apprenticeship hours and do some work beforehand before you're allowed to get the license. And you also have to fulfill, in many cases, you have to pass a criminal background check or just a good character background check to satisfy the license board and then pay all the fees of the licensing boards.
John, one might think, well, that sounds, frankly, kind of reasonable if you're talking about, say, a physician or a nurse, someone for whom you want to make sure that they have a level of expertise and skill, because if they mess up, it could be catastrophic consequences. But occupational licensing in North Carolina and other states goes well beyond physicians.
Oh, yes. And in 2004, the Council of State Governments found that there were over 1,100 different occupations that were licensed in at least one state. The interesting thing about that is only about 5% are licensed in all the states, so only about 60 of those occupations are licensed in all 50 states, which means that there's a great deal of disagreement among the states over what really should be licensed or where there should be freedom in that occupation.
Here in North Carolina, what types of job categories are we talking about that require these the training, the fees, all of this expertise in order to just go try to make a living?
I mean, there's plenty of things. Some things that you think about, like the medical professions, but then also you need a license to braid hair.
Braid hair.
You need a license to be a preschool teacher. You need a license to do a lot of trades, a lot of the construction trades, for example. They're just tons and tons of different things.
Landscapers, locksmiths, I think, are ensnared into this whole regulatory regime.
There's over 700 tasks that require licenses to do, and in occupations there are about 180-some.
Well, the Wall Street Journal recently picked up on this and wrote this editorial that you brought to the attention of your colleagues at the Locke Foundation, and this focused on the state of Nebraska and the fact that lawmakers there are trying to take a look at their state's regime of all of this licensing. And John, I know when you read the Wall Street Journal editorial, you said, you know what, sounds pretty familiar because, in fact, you've been recommending a lot of the reforms that Nebraska's looking at.
What struck me in reading that editorial is everything that the Wall Street Journal editors pulled out to praise about it were things that we had specifically recommended in our policy position on occupational licensing. It would have periodic review, like 20% in this bill, 20% of the licenses would come under review every year. So within 5 years, all of the licenses would be reviewed by a legislative committee.
Reviewed just to make sure that they're still necessary, or maybe they're not. Maybe you could get rid of one or modify one.
Right. Modify the cost. So that was another one, is how does it align with other states? If another state licenses, how does it allow that state's license to transfer? How does it align with the costs of those other states? So it looks at it from that angle. And also it asks, is this something that we need to license, or are there other ways that the state can accomplish the regulatory goal of ensuring safety and quality of the work without putting an entry regulation which keeps someone from actually beginning work?
John, that's an interesting point because you've written a lot on this issue about the least restrictive approach. And I think that's what you're getting at here, because clearly people want to make sure that if someone is providing some sort of technical service for them, that it's quality work. But you point out that when it comes to public safety, there are other ways to do it. Tell us about that.
Well, for example, if you're worried about it depends on the kind of work. If you're worried about third-party effects or downstream damages and that sort of thing, then you would want to have something like bonding or insurance. You wouldn't actually need to go all the way to licensing if the concern would be taken care of by having bonding or insurance. Or if you're worried about cleanliness, then you would just require inspections. If you're worried about, for example, something where a consumer wouldn't have any idea of how to judge the quality of the work, then you would require certification. Or sometimes that's a case for getting insurance reimbursement. So you would have the state require and honor voluntary certification of these things. If you're worried about fly-by-night providers coming in, and this sometimes is a concern after a major storm has hit and there's roofing that needs to be done or driveways or things that need to be cleared, then you have registration with the Secretary of State, and then you also strengthen the state's law against fraudulent practices and deceptive trade practices.
John, it sounds as if you are recommending consequences for people who don't provide the quality of product or service that they have contracted with their customer to provide. And that's kind of on the end of the process versus trying to make it really, really tough for people to get into the industry in the first place.
Right. And then that's the way we approach almost all of the businesses and endeavors in this state. I mean, we allow the government to enforce on the back end of things. I mean, if you have a bad experience with a provider, with a service provider, you're free to take them to court. You have that tort. And the government is involved in that aspect of it.
John, I remember when I was a kid and my mom would be in the kitchen, there was something called the Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval. Mm-hmm. And as an adult, now and then I've seen Underwriters Laboratories on different things. Are those examples of what you're talking about?
Those are other examples of the private market filling a role. And the nice thing about living in this time is we have social media. I mean, the Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval is big, but what about the Facebook Seal of Approval? When you find out if your friends and neighbors have had a positive experience or a negative experience with a local provider or a local company, it doesn't matter what, you're going to take those things to heart, and they're going to know it.
And it's just that form of communication that everybody gets to let someone else know. Lots of people know I had a good experience or I had a bad experience, and that tends to level out the marketplace in a lot of ways. Lastly, John, how prevalent is this in North Carolina, and how much of a problem and a challenge is it for our lawmakers?
Well, North Carolina has more licenses than most states. We're on the upper end of aggressive licensing. Fortunately, in the last few years, especially since the GOP has taken control of the legislature, we have not seen licensing grow. And I'm hoping that we can, in the next few years, join a few other states that have actually turned it around and started to free up their occupations. I'd love to see that here.
You can read all of John's work at johnlock.org. John, thanks very much.
Thank you, Don.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. We hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.